We are in Luke chapter 16, and we will begin a few weeks series on giving. You've already heard a lot about giving today, and some of you may, as I said earlier, cringe at these thoughts about money. Money brings up all kinds of thoughts in our hearts and our minds. We think about debt. We think about paying bills. We think about savings. We think about all the things that we need to do with our money. Money is the number one reason for divorce in our country. Money drives much of our passions, our desires. It is the leading cause of worry in probably most of our lives here today. And it's important that we understand money in terms of the gospel, not so that we would be guilted into giving more, but so that we would be free. So that we would be free to understand what is of most value and what requires most of our time and our heart and what money says about our hearts. And so that's what we're going to do the next few weeks as we move through this vision giving time in the life of our church. And then the last 4 weeks of the year, we will have a Christmas theme as we talk about the incarnation. But today we are in Luke chapter 16. And I'm going to read verses 10 through 13, but we're going to look at the first 16 verses of this chapter. If you would stand in reverence to the reading of God's perfect word. Luke chapter 16, beginning in verse 10. Jesus says to us, we have the words of Christ here, the inspiration of the Holy Spirit to penetrate our lives in these moments, to change what is going on in our families, to change what is going on, even in the secret, as we have just sung about, what is going on in our lives. We hear the word of Christ, which lays us open, and he says to us, one who is faithful in very little is also faithful in much, and one who is dishonest in very little is also dishonest in much. If then you have not been faithful in unrighteous wealth, who will entrust to you true riches? And if you have not been faithful in that which is another's, who will give you that which is your own? No servant can serve two masters, for he will either hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and money. Oh God, teach us today what those words mean for us. May they not remain in the generic. May they not remain abstract and distant. But may we look at our checkbooks, our saving accounts, our investments, our debt, and be reminded we can't serve money and Jesus at the same time. May we leave here today loving Jesus, not money. It's in the name of Christ we pray. Amen. You may be seated. Many years ago, I was coaching one of my son's t-ball teams, and it was the first day of practice, and you know how that goes. You're getting to know the families. You're trying to introduce yourself to the moms and dads present. And there was one family there that had several kids. And by several, I mean more than two. Many kids running around. And normally, my family is the only one who attracts attention by the number of children. And so this family was somewhat unique, standing out. They were also syrupy, sweet and nice, smiling, very, very nice. And with a smile on their face, they walked up to me and they informed me that their sons, they had twins on the team, would never be at anything that we ever did on Sunday. Not practices, not games. Their kids would never be there. With a smile on their face, they informed me of this. And it was due to church. And immediately, that was something I could appreciate. And I sort of said, well, I know I'm a pastor. I know how that goes. And I've even learned from the way that they have handled that. They handled that issue as I coached their sons, just up front telling me what their convictions were. And so there was no question if we had a game scheduled for a Sunday, that family wouldn't be there. Don't even ask. Don't even think. They're not going to be there. They weren't jerks about it. But what is tragic is as I watch that family, the way they interacted with their kids, the way they were at practice and the way they talked to me, I didn't think this family, I didn't think, wow, that's a family that must be committed to a local Southern Baptist church. They're nice. They have convictions. They go to church every Sunday. I didn't think, wow, they must be Southern Baptist. No, I immediately thought those folks must be Mormons. And so I asked them, hey, where are you guys from? Utah. Knew exactly where they were coming from with their convictions, with their hospitality. I knew exactly what was going on there. And I coached their kids for 2 years and actually built a relationship with them. I was in seminary at the time, and it came to a point I had to do a research paper on Mormonism. And so I hung out with them. I interviewed their family. I actually went to some of the meetings that they had at their church for research purposes. I did interviews. And while I am more convinced after that time being around that family and getting to know more about that church, that the Mormon church preaches a wicked, false gospel that declares Jesus is not the Son of God. I want to be very, very clear about that. But as I was around that family, I was convicted over and over again about their commitment and their loyalty to what they believed. They never wavered in their convictions. They were upfront about who they were. And I was impressed, even as I attended some of their church meetings and studied just how they went about things, the loyalty that was present in their church, the way their church did missions. My friend was sent here from Utah to study medicine to become a doctor so he could help lead a church in Louisville, and it was all paid for by his church. And as we talked, I was impressed by the way that they did everything with excellence, the discipleship among men, the sort of accountability that was there. I was taken back by it all, and I was convicted about the way that we do church, about the way we carry out our mission. We declare we are committed to the exclusivity of Christ. No one will enter the gates of heaven apart from believing that Jesus is the Son of God. They will live forever in eternal torment, those who reject the Christ that we preach from the gospel of this book. And yet so often we pale in comparison when it comes to our commitment. And I want to be clear. Ultimately, it's a wicked abomination before God what their church teaches, but I was convicted by their distinctions. And I was convicted, by the way, when folks see us interact at the ballpark, when folks see us interact at the restaurant, when folks hear about our convictions, they don't see us coming. They don't think those folks must go to a Baptist church. Those must be evangelical Christians. Jesus tells a story here to show us that at times we see kingdom wisdom in the world, and it should rebuke us in that way. He does so in chapter 16 by telling a story, as he often does. In verse 1, Jesus said to his disciples, he has just told the parable of the prodigal son. He has just rebuked the Pharisees. And now he turns to his disciples and he says, while we're all listening, let me tell you a story. There was a rich man who had a manager. And charges were brought to him that this man was wasting his possessions. And so there's a man, and he owns a lot of property. He owns a lot of real estate. Maybe he's in the farming business. But he has a lot of money, and he has set this manager over his affairs. Now, this manager here is found to be lazy, unorganized. He is wasting this man's money. And so in verse 2, he called him to him. And he said, "What is this I hear of you? Turn in the account of your management, for you can no longer be a manager. You are wasting my money. You are taking what is mine and you are not investing it properly. You are not collecting my money in the way that it should be." And so he Donald Trumps him. He fires him. "Turn in your keys. We'll get security to escort you out." And then verse 3, the manager said to himself as he's walking out, "What shall I do? Since my master is taking my management away from me, this is all I've ever known. I'm not strong enough to dig. I can't do manual labor. I've sat in an office all these years. And I am ashamed to beg. I am known as the CEO manager. There is no way for me to enter the workforce now as a digger, as a beggar. I can't do this." And then he thinks, verse 4, and decides what he will do. "I've decided what to do so that when I am removed from management, people may receive me into their houses. I figured out a plan. I know folks. I've been involved in the business. Now I'm going to use my name. I'm going to use my position for all of these years to take advantage of folks so that I might receive favors from them. I might have a place to stay. I might have more work. I might have money." Verse 5. So summoning his master's debtors, one by one, he said to the first, "How much do you owe my master?" And he said, 100 measures of oil. And he said to him, "Take your bill and set down quickly and write 50. And so he gives him a half-off discount. "You owe my master 100 measures, just give him 50 and give it to me now." Then verse 7, he said to another, "How much do you owe?" And he said, 100 measures of wheat. And he said to him, "Take your bill and write 80. Gives him a 20% discount. "Give me what you owe my master now. Give it to me now." Now, you can only imagine if you're the master what your thoughts are when you realize what's been going on by this guy who is actually doing you wrong. Think about how you would respond. Notice what the master does, verse 8. The master commended the dishonest manager for his shrewdness. He says, "Wow, this guy has some street smarts. Wow, look at the way this guy has sort of taken this situation and used it for his benefit. Sure, I'm out money now, but you got to give the guy credit for what he's done. You got me. This is amazing, the wisdom this guy has displayed here." It's kind of like when you tell your kids to do something and they're not moving, they're not cleaning their room, they're not picking up what you ask them to do. And you say, "Okay, you don't pick that up, you don't go outside, you don't go to the game, you don't do this." And all of a sudden, they turn into this workforce. And all of a sudden, you see deals being made with one another. "I'll do this, you do this." You see even these excuses that seem to be so legitimate that just come out of nowhere. And you think, wow, you've got to give them credit for the creativity. You got to give them credit for the shrewdness here. And Jesus says this sort of shrewdness is honored in the world. He wants to point out here that the way in which this manager has acted is something the world values, where you sort of make friends and you influence people because you realize you will need them later on. And so you protect yourself. And so you take advantage of others. You play the game. You move up the ladder no matter what. And at the end of the day, it doesn't matter whatever means you use. You played the game and you won. And at the end of the day, others will applaud you. Others will give you raises for the way you play the game. If you can make your boss money, no matter how you do it, you will move up in the company. Donald Trump, a lot of money, just an outright jerk. But people applaud him in the business world. He gains a voice, even in our country. Steve Jobs, awful dad. Read his biography. The things he said to his kids about why he needed to make money, and they would just have to pretty much just get over it. But people applaud him. Scrolling on the phone right now that he helped design and the company that he helped make. This is the game you play in the business world. Gossip, slander, being two-faced. And we begin to think, yeah, the worldly ethic is just disgusting. Yeah, just sort of moving up the ladder, taking advantage of others. It doesn't matter how you treat others. That is horrible. I see it every day at work. I see the gossip. I see the slander. I see people just grasping for what is theirs, never minding the consequences. And I see them getting raises. I see them moving up in the company. And as we are discussed it, Jesus says, hold on a second. Here's why I'm telling you this story. Notice the second part of verse 8. For the sons of the world, those who are of the world, are more shrewd in dealing with their own generation than the sons of light. The reason this man was commended was for his shrewdness. And he says, I want you to look at the world, and I want you to see how they act. And that should serve as a rebuke to you who are children of light, by the way that you interact with the world, the way you do things in the world. You see, good preaching always flips it. And Jesus does that over and over. Good preaching always says, hey, we're not here to talk about abstract people that's just out there. No, we're here to talk about how does this apply to us. As a church, we always want to take the word of God, not just say the world, the world, the world. No, we want to say, what about us? That's why in your BFGs, you don't talk about generalities. Folks out there, you talk about how this applies to me and my family. And that's what Jesus does here. I didn't tell this story as some abstract thing for us to feel better about ourselves. No, I want you to ask how you act among this present generation, you who have something that is eternal, among those who are engaged with the temporary. And he points out this kingdom shrewdness that we are to have even as we look at the worldly shrewdness of the world. He says, here, there is an urgency with the temporary. And he flips and he says, what about you who are sons of light who have eternal, the eternal? There is wisdom with what will perish, money. He begins to call it unrighteous wealth, mammon, stuff of this world. What about you with things that are imperishable? The gospel of Jesus Christ. You look at the world and you see their ambition. You look at the world and you see their vision. It's not to all of a sudden be lazy. It's not to all of a sudden to lack ambition or vision in the world. As you see those climbing the ladder, Jesus calls us to redeem such shrewdness for the sake of the gospel. The question is here, you see folks passionate about the American dream. You see folks working long hours. You see students at school who have given themselves over to academic achievement. And you're not to say, oh, that's worldly. No, you're to say, how can I have such ambition for the sake of the gospel? How can I have such shrewdness for the sake of the gospel? College football coaches who give their life over to the task, rarely seeing their family on the recruiting trail. This time of year, they are the most scrutinized people on the planet. And they have given themselves over to such a task. And you say, oh, that's just worldly. That's just disgusting. Well, what about you with the gospel? You see people at work who stab others in the back to move up. But you have a different ethic. The last shall be first. But that doesn't mean you're lazy. That doesn't mean you lack ambition. You take that passion, you take that wisdom, and you redeem it for the sake of the gospel. You take your convictions that are latched to what is eternal, and you invest what is temporary in this kingdom that is coming, that will sweep into the world, that will make all things right. He continues to explain here. He says, I tell you, make friends for yourself by unrighteous wealth. Now, this term, unrighteous wealth, it could be mammon, it could just be money that is temporary. It's not necessarily wicked money. Although in the context, that's what's happened, this dishonest manager. Money here in many ways is neutral, and that's the point he's making. He says, you make friends for yourself with money in this way so that when it fails, they may receive you into their eternal dwellings. He says, this man has made friends with money so that he can have temporary success. You take what is yours and you invest it in eternity so that you look around and you will see folks in heaven because of what you do with what God gives you. You invest in eternity with your stuff, with your money. He says, even the world realizes that money is used for relationships, that money is used for a certain benefit. You use it for the sake of the gospel. Here, Jesus redeems our thoughts about money. Think for a moment as we approach Christmas. Think about the gifts you bought last Christmas. Not that they were in vain, not that they're just junk, but think about what's being done with them right now. I have a 14-year-old that you bought him something last month and he can't even wear it now. His friends on the baseball team were making fun of him because he was wearing high waters the other day. They said, are you wearing your youngest brother's pants? But just think about the things you gave and you invested in even a month ago, even a year ago. Think about that phone. We got to have the new iPhone. We're going to sleep out front of the Apple store. We're going to camp out for a little phone, for a little watch. And then, oh, that's not as good as the last one. You got that junky old iPad 1 still. Hey, think about the things, the way our culture moves. Those things are not necessarily evil, but think about the things you invest in and just how temporary it is. Think about the car you drove last year. You got in all the bells and whistles. This is amazing. I can talk on my phone in this. I just get in and it connects to my phone and I can text with my voice. And now you're thinking, man, that's a lot of trouble. I wish you could just read my thoughts. But just think about the way our world is driven toward the temporariness. And Jesus says, you take that passion, you take those desires, you take those investments, you take that shrewdness, you take what is temporary and you invest it in the eternal. Instead of using money for yourself, use it for an eternal good of others. His point here is we are dealing with heaven and hell. Notice this word eternal. And as we see here, it will be pitted against what is temporary now. And he says, I want you to see that picture clearly. Heaven and hell is at stake in what we are doing here. There are 7 billion people in the world. 4 billion are unreached. There are 11,200 different people groups, different nations, ethnicities. 300 of those have yet to be engaged with the gospel. 200 million people who have never been engaged with the gospel. And we sit here today and we say that is the only way of salvation for anyone, anywhere. Why would we not give more to that cause? And Jesus' point here is why would you not seek to make more to give to that cause? Why would you not save more to give to that cause? Why would you not do with less to give to that cause? Examine your heart. Do you really believe this is an eternal issue? And he explains it this way, beginning in verse 10. He says, the one who is faithful in very little is also faithful in much. If you are faithful in very little, which is what you have now, compared to eternity, the money, the possessions, the stuff you have now is actually very little. If you are in Christ, you claim that a zillion years from now, you will be in the new heavens, in the new earth, serving Jesus. This lifespan and what you acquire now is very little in the span of eternity. How are you managing the little that is given to you? Are you stealing from God? If so, you will be dishonest in much. What is eternal? He says, if then you have not been faithful in unrighteous wealth, in the affairs of your temporary wealth, your money, who will entrust you to true riches? If you can't manage your bank account, why should God give you the precious treasure of the gospel to manage? That's his point. He's digging into the issue of our heart here. And if you have not been faithful in that which is another's, your boss's money, that which your company profits, what your company gives to you, the resources that you handle on a daily basis, your job in general, if you can't be faithful in the task that is in front of you, who will give you that which is yours, which you claim is the gospel, which you claim is this eternal inheritance? He says, if you can't be faithful now, why should God give you any more? It's the same thing I tell my kids when we're leaving the house. Our kids are at a time where we leave the house and Danae will go, I'll go out on a date and we'll look at a few of them and we'll say, you're in charge. And it's not always according to age, because there are some that are extremely responsible and there are others who are less responsible. And we say, hey, you are faithful in this way. You manage things this way. Here's the cell phone. You're in charge. It's the same thing we tell seminary students at our church. We say, you claim to be called to the ministry. Okay, move some chairs. Let's watch your attitude as you move chairs. Serve on front line. You claim to be called to this glorious gospel ministry. Let's see how you handle the small things. Let's see if you're on time for church. Let's watch the way you carry yourself. Because if you can't be faithful simply attending church and being on time, hey, guess what? You can't be late preaching a sermon. You got to be on time. And so let's see if you're faithful in those things. If you can't sustain and grow a BFG, it's probably not going to happen in the context of a church. If you are faithful, if you claim to have this eternal inheritance, you will be faithful in what God has given you now. Consider this. God has deemed us all, what Jesus is talking about here, he has deemed us all rulers in waiting. We have been latched to his kingdom. Jesus will rule. Jesus will reign forever. And we will be a part of that. We will serve with him forever. God has deemed us all eternal CEOs. And he says, you have a temporary post now. Are you acting like an eternal CEO? Are you acting like a ruler in waiting? If you realize you are latched to eternal purposes of God, you will manage even your bank account in that way. You will see your job, whether it's an engineer, doctor, or a greeter at Walmart, as a temporary post, and you will dominate it for the glory of Christ. By the way, it's not bad to be good at what you do. It's not bad as a Christian to be good at what you do and to get raises and to acquire more money. That is a good thing. We want the folks in our church moving up in their company because that means they take the gospel seriously. That means they take character and integrity seriously. But then the question Jesus asks is, what are you doing as you accomplish those things? It says everything about who you believe you are within the eternal purposes of God. As a stay-at-home mom, changing diapers matters for eternity. It does. Are you faithful in the diaper changing? Are you faithful in the little? Do you realize as you change the diapers, as you prepare breakfast, as you feed your breakfast, as you feed your kids lunch, as you move and interact with these kids throughout the day, do you realize that's latched to a zillion years from now? If you do so, there is a weight that comes with that responsibility. And God has entrusted you with these souls, and you are investing in them for the purposes of God forever. You are waging war against the forces of darkness every second. It gives you a new purpose. Right? If it's just to get the paycheck and move on, who cares? Who cares? Ultimately, who cares? You're grasping at what is moving away, as what is being blown away like chaff. You are reaching for it, and yeah, I got some of it, but there it goes again, and that's your life. Jesus says, no, take what you have and invest it in eternity, because that's who you are. You are an eternal son of God. Then he says, verse 13, he presses it home here. He says, no one can serve two masters, for he will either hate the one and love the other, or be devoted to the one and despise the other. Now, the terminology used here is one of worship. You rever one of these masters, and you serve them. You do whatever they say. You become a slave to them. You hate the one, and you love the other. And here he's talking about God and money. And he says, you can't serve God and money at the same time. God will either be a tool for you to get more money, or money will be a tool for you to serve Jesus. One of them will be a tool, and one of them will be your master. Worldly shrewdness is marked by slavery to money. Kingdom shrewdness makes money your slave to serve Jesus. And you say, money does what I tell it to do, which is investing in the eternal purposes of God. He says, Jesus will be your master, or money will be your master. Jesus will be your tool for more money, or money will be your tool for Jesus. One or the other. He doesn't leave money as a neutral thing. I know some of you are saying, let's don't talk about money. I don't even want to think about my credit card debt. I don't want to think about the balance on my checking account right now. I don't want to think about all these toys and stuff that I got to buy for Christmas. I don't want to think about that. We still haven't paid off last Christmas, and I don't want to think about money, especially at church. I came here to worship Jesus and feel good and leave. Well, Jesus says it doesn't work that way. Jesus preaches more about money and hell than anything else. Why? He wants to be clear, it's not neutral. And notice what the religious leaders who are standing by do, which is a rebuke to us, the religious folks. He says the Pharisees, who were lovers of money, they took their money as a tool for self-righteousness. What they did with their money declared who they were according to their religion. And so they would give it to the temple, they would show up at the temple, and there would be people outside blowing horns. Hey, look what he's giving today. And they would bring coins and they would drop it in. Ling, 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 ling. Look, wow, look how much he gave. And he says, you are a lover of... Amen. He says, you are a lover of money, except it just looks differently. You love money because you think you are earning something before God with it. And in all actuality, you're just earning something before men. He says, money is your master in a totally different way. And so what Jesus is doing here is he's protecting us from thinking we can pay God off. God doesn't need our money. We are to use it for the sake of the gospel. And he says to the Pharisees here as he continues, he said to them, you are those who justify yourselves before men. You want to talk about money? The way you use money is simply an act before men. But God knows your heart. And as he would say to them, you on the outside are a whitewashed tomb. On the inside, you're full of dead men's bones. And he says, what is exalted among men is an abomination in the sight of God. He wants to turn to the religious folks and say, the way you use money is just as bad. You think you're paying God off, and that's not the point either. This whole parable could apply to the Pharisees. They make friends with their money for religious gains. They require less of men. God demands his righteousness, righteousness that exceeds the Pharisees. They require less. They receive their reward in full, and the shrewdness that they exhibit is something Satan, their father, honors. It could be a rebuke to them. And what Jesus' point here is, don't disconnect the stewardship of money from your commitment to the gospel. Some of you don't want to talk about it, but it's impossible. Money is necessary in the world in which we live. And Jesus says, I want you to examine your heart. Money is an indicator of your heart. Your checking account, your credit card statement, how you tithe at church is a display of your heart. What do you treasure? Who do you think you are? Is this all that matters? What I can get now, is that all that matters? And while he wants to protect us from that, he doesn't want us to devalue money either. Just if you have money, it's bad. It's the root of all evil. It's not evil. He says, I want you to take it and crucify it and use it for the sake of the gospel. But here's the heart of our problem, Jesus gets to, is that we really think we can have our best life now. You think this is your best life right now. You think the span of 80 years is all you got. And I got to get it now. And that's why we talk about bucket list. I got to go to the Grand Canyon before I die. I got to go to all the Major League Baseball stadiums before I die. I got to get all of that in here and now before I die. I've got to achieve something here that I'll never be able to achieve again. And what Jesus is saying is, whoa, your ruler's in waiting. You have an eternal king. What you have coming to you will blow your mind. Grand Canyon, psht. Think about Grand Canyon redeemed by the glory of Christ, and you can go there whenever you want. I don't know if that's what's going to happen, but just think about it. Whatever will happen will be better than that. He says, think about it. Think about how you've been deceived and thinking, I got to get it in now. And some of you are here today and you're thinking about your career. And you're thinking, I got to get it in now. I got to be somebody now. I got to make my parents proud. I got to have something for my kids to pass off. I got to do it now. I got to do it now. I got to do it now. Or I will be nobody when they lay me. Jesus says, if you're in the kingdom, that's foolish thinking. You may not have a penny to your name this morning. He says, but you have an eternal kingdom that's going to be handed to you. Compare what you have now to eternity. And some of you are thinking, I've wasted my life. I chose the wrong career path. I made bad decisions. Jesus also says that's foolish too. He says, take what you have now and use kingdom shrewdness. Pour it into the gospel from this point on. Give for the sake of the gospel from this point on. Use money as a tool for Jesus. And it begins today by realizing that we've all wasted it. If you're here today and you say, I've never wasted one second of my life. I've never wasted one penny of my money. Then you're a liar. Period. The point of the parable is that's what we all do. We coast, we serve ourselves, and then we are reminded that there is a king coming, and Jesus says, get ready. Make the most of what you have now. Whether it's 10 years left, whether it's 15 years left, whether it's 75 years left, don't waste it. You've been warned. Invest in the gospel. Give for the sake of the kingdom. The truth is, we have all cut corners. We've all cut corners with God. We've tried to do less than what he requires. Man, I just don't want to be laid in the ground And then right across that stone, he wasted it. I don't think you would do that, but I don't want folks thinking that. I remind myself of that every single day. When I get tired, when I am struck with the lazy bug, oh man, why waste another second? Jesus has given me eternity. I want to be faithful now. I want to be given over to the task now. I want to use all the resources. I want to be more passionate than the folks in the world. The folks that I interact with in the world who are passionate about their jobs, about their career, they're given over to those things. I want to be more passionate for Jesus than they are for things that will waste away. What about you? What about you? That's the question Jesus asks us today.